This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more details, see jodcast.net.
So we're here with Peter Curran from the Mullard Space Science Laboratory at UCL. First of all, thank you for taking the time to speak to me today.
Thanks for having me.
And could you tell me a little bit about your research, please?
My research basically involves taking as much data as we can find for the afterglow, so the long-term emission from the gamma ray burst, and we try to look at it in X-rays and as many optical bands as possible. We then combine the X-ray and the optical to get spectra and light curves, and then we try to find the intrinsic physical parameters that might be at work in the burst itself. So the parameters we're interested in mainly is how the blast wave accelerates the electrons. That's one parameter. The next we're interested in is how the density of matter around the star falls off with radius. So we want to know if there's a constant density around the star, or does it fall off like you would expect from a solar wind. And we're also interested in trying to find out if there's much energy injection. It's thought that at late times, the central engine, the black hole at the center of the gamma ray burst, might still be emitting some energy, and we want to try to parameterize or find out how much energy is being released by the gamma ray burst at late times. And you can see this in a number of ways, either a smooth amount of energy being released, or sometimes the energy is released in massive flares, some of the flares being almost as energetic as the initial burst itself. So that's what I do, look at the multi-wavelength data from the GRBs to try to get some of the physical parameters of interest.
Is there any favoured model for the actual production of a GRB jet?
The favourite model for the production of the jet is referred to as the fireball or blast wave model. A GRB starts life as a very massive star, around 20 solar masses. This star reaches the end of its life cycle and begins to collapse down to a black hole. In certain special cases, this collapse will lead to a gamma ray burst. Often a collapse like this leads to a supernova, but in a subsection of that, it'll also lead to a GRB. So all the mass that was around the star, that made up the outer layers of the star, falls into the black hole. As this huge amount of mass falls into a black hole, a lot of gravitational energy needs to be released. The main way this gravitational energy is released is via two symmetric jets which travel along the north pole and the south pole of the newly collapsed black hole. These jets plow into the medium around the star, around the black hole, and as they plow into this medium, they act like a pressure wave, almost like a sound wave. Just as the way a sound agitates the particles of air, the blast wave of the GRB agitates or excites the particles, the electrons, around the black hole. When these electrons are agitated, they're accelerated, and then they can interact with the magnetic field and emit radiation via synchrotron emission. This emission is what we're able to see from billions of light years across the galaxy. Most of your GRBs are at quite a high redshift, which means they're at a very high distance from us. So the light from them, by the time we observe it, has travelled 10 billion light years from a time when the galaxy, when the universe, was only around 10% of its current age.
So we know there are two types of GRBs, short and long. Could you tell me what the difference is, please?
That's right. When they were originally detected, they seemed to fall into two discrete groups with a bit of blur where the line distinguishing them might be. Short GRBs are around less than 2 seconds, while long GRBs are greater than 2 seconds in duration. Now, that's not where the differences end. There is actually a physical difference between the two. Long GRBs are caused by the collapse of a massive star into a black hole. Short GRBs are thought to be due to either a neutron star and a neutron star spiraling inwards together and actually coalescing or joining, which releases a huge amount of energy, or a neutron star and a black hole doing the same thing, coalescing and releasing that amount of energy. So the actual physical source of the GRB is different. However, in both cases, they release a huge amount of gravitational energy, which powers a relativistic jet, which is what we can see.
So what particles are we actually interested in here? Protons, electrons, or anything in particular?
It's mainly the electrons that are accelerated. The protons are too heavy, so the electrons are accelerated, and the main reason we're interested in those is because the electrons are the ones that are able to emit the most energy via the synchrotron emission.
Now, you recently gave a talk on particle acceleration in the jets of gamma ray bursts from Swift observations. Can you tell me anything further about that, please?
Yeah, what we did was we looked at a number of Swift GRBs that were very well sampled in the X-ray and the optical. So we weren't just using Swift, we were using the X-ray telescope on Swift, we were using the ultraviolet optical telescope on Swift, but we also used a huge number of ground-based observatories from the Canaries to Hawaii to Australian observatories. And we took all of this data, put it together, and we tried to make sense out of the light curves and the spectra.
Okay, so there are actual benefits of using the SWIFT telescope data.
Before SWIFT arrived, there was a number of satellites, but they were very slow in detecting and reporting a gamma ray burst. So you might not know about a gamma ray burst until 12 hours after it happens. And considering a gamma ray burst only lasts for a couple of seconds, sometimes if a gamma ray burst lasts for 50 seconds, it's considered a very long gamma ray burst. It then fades very, very quickly. So 12 hours is way too late to actually detect a gamma ray burst in most cases. SWIFT, what SWIFT does, it has a gamma ray detector which detects the bursts themselves. And within seconds, the entire SWIFT satellite slews or looks in the direction of the gamma ray burst. It then looks at it with its X-ray telescope and its optical telescope. These are important because the afterglow, which is that blast wave going into the circumburst medium, is what causes the afterglow, which is what we see in the optical and the X-rays, and which allows us to study the long-term effects of the gamma ray burst.
Are there any benefits of observing gamma ray bursts at other frequencies, such as radio, once they've actually dissipated in the shock region?
Yes, in all the different observing regimes, we can see gamma ray bursts in, from the initial gamma ray radiation to the longer-term X-ray and optical radiation to the extremely long-term radio radiation. We can find a different piece of the puzzle that's allowing us to put together what's happening within the gamma ray burst at early times and at late times. Radio can be particularly interesting because even though it's much weaker than any of the other light we see from a gamma ray burst, it lasts much longer. Most gamma ray bursts are detected in gamma rays for just a few seconds. They're detected in X-rays and opticals for days to maybe a few weeks. In radio, if they're detected, they can be detected for months, or even in some extreme cases, years. With the new LOFAR telescope, which is being built in the Netherlands at the moment, there has been some approximations done, and they think that they'll be able to detect a gamma ray burst when it comes online next year. They're going to be able to detect a gamma ray burst that occurred 10 years ago, which will be the latest observation of a gamma ray burst ever.
So are there many actual difficulties with understanding a GRB in terms of its association with maybe its progenitor?
There's a lot of selection effects in any of these things. A lot of work has been done in trying to tie down the association between a given gamma ray burst and, say, its progenitor or its host galaxy. In the case of long gamma ray bursts, they've been associated with the star-forming regions of galaxies or with star-forming galaxies. However, these are extremely far away, so even if you can see a galaxy, you're not seeing much detail in that galaxy. Short gamma ray bursts, on the other hand, because of their different progenitors, which we're pretty sure of now, are not associated with star-forming galaxies. They're either associated with different types of galaxies, or they're not associated with galaxies at all. And this is because if short gamma ray bursts are caused by the coalescing of a neutron star and a neutron star, those neutron stars normally get a kick velocity because those neutron stars are normally formed with a supernova explosion, which gives them a kick outside their host galaxy, and that's why short gamma ray bursts are not associated with any particular type of host. There's still a lot of developments to be made in gamma ray bursts. The first detection of a gamma ray burst was only in the late 1960s, so they've only been around for 40 years. And up until the mid-90s, they were only ever detected in gamma rays for a few seconds. It was only 10 years ago that people started observing them in X-rays and optical, which they were able to observe for a much longer time and start making sense of them. Now the Fermi Space Telescope is detecting a much higher energies than was ever detected before. So that's giving us information about the very early high energy emission. And in general, as the sample, as the number of GRBs we've observed grows, we're getting a little more understanding. At the moment, every GRB seems to be slightly different from the one before it, and some GRBs, more than answering questions, seem to ask more questions.
Okay, thank you very much.